up his palm, twist his wrist, kick the inside of his thigh, and the next thing I know, he's flat on his back, and I have my knee dangerously close to his fucking balls. Emily gasps, Tyler claps and shouts, "Fuck yeah, baby!" And Ricky stares up at me with a look that's half surprised, half impressed, and says,
"Okay, then. And which was that? Aikido, jiu-jitsu, Wing Chun?"
Breathing heavy, and with no real clear image in my head of what exactly just happened, I let go of his arm, stand up, step back, and say, "Pretty sure that was just Maddie Clayton."
Chapter 8. Tyler. The mood in the firehouse is heavy. I came by for lunch. I've been spending all my time with Maddie, and I haven't even really seen Evan since the funeral. But the air in here is thick. Jeff's death is still fresh in everyone's mind. It probably will be for a while. Losing someone is always tough, but when it's a guy like Jeff, who was young and eager and had his whole life ahead of him, it's downright Shakespearean. So even though I'm losing my shit over Maddie offering herself up as a lure to reeling Castillo, I'm trying my best not to freak out about it in front of Evan and the guys. "Dude, I am freaking out about this shit with Maddie," I say. "Fuck." Evan nods. "Yeah, well, that's understandable. Be weird if you weren't." "Who exactly is this guy?" "Which guy?" I say.
"The fucking guy," Rod chimes in. "This fucking drug guy, fucking Richie, what's his name?"
"Ricky," I say.
"Yeah, fucking Ricky, Ricky fucking drug fuck, what's his story?"
"His story? I don't know. He was in the military, got out, now he's a DEA agent, all I really know about him."
"Yeah? He trying to fuck your old lady?"
"Rod," Bear says with some exhaustion in his voice. "Go play in traffic."
"Fuck did I say? I'm just asking questions."
"No, Rod," I say. "I don't think he's trying to fuck Maddie. Of all the things I'm worried about with this whole setup, Ricky's prick is not one."
"Yeah?"
says Rod, grinning.
"Why? You seen it? He got a teeny peeny?"
Bear pushes Rod's chair with his foot and Rod falls over backwards. Nobody else moves. I get the feeling it happens a lot.
"Why you gotta be a dick?"
shouts Rod. "So you trust the guy?" asks Bear, ignoring his half-sized cohort.
"No, I didn't say that." I stand up from the table and start pacing a little.
"Fuck, should I trust him? He's recruiting an untrained asset off the street? That seems... I don't know. The whole thing just makes me uneasy."
"Yo, brother, let me ask you something."
That's Dean.
"Are you supposed to be talking about all this shit to us? I mean, it's cool. Pretty sure none of us are gonna say nothing to nobody, but still."
"Oh, yeah," I say. "I mean, yeah, I got a whole big lecture about secrecy and all that shit, but I'm assuming it really only applies to Maddie's roommates."
"Why?"
asks Dean.
"Because they're hookers. You know how chatty pros can be."
"Nah, man," he says.
"I really don't. Never paid for that shit."
"Of course he hasn't. Fucking Dean. So fucking cool. Asshole."
"I gotta tell you,"
says Alex, lumbering to his feet, collecting everyone's empty lunch plates.
"When people ask me why I don't believe in relationships, I'm gonna tell them this story."
"What?" says Bear.
"You don't believe in relationships because a Mexican drug lord might fall in love with your woman and she could possibly get approached by an undercover DEA agent to become involved in an off-the-books op to try to bring him down?"
Alex grabs up the last plate, stares at the floor, considering the question, and after a beat says,
"Yeah, exactly,"
and then ambles off into the kitchen. Bear turns to me and asks,
"Is there anything we can do, man?"
"No," I say. "I mean, fuck, I don't know, but no. Of course not. I wish there was. Thanks."
"Well," says Bear, hauling his massive frame up to its full height, "we're always here for you if you need anything. You know that, right?"
He sticks his hand out. I take it and we shake.
"Yeah, I know, man. Thanks."
He pulls me toward him with his monstrous grip and says again,
"Right?"
Most people will say things like, "I'm here for you if you need me," or "let me know if I can do anything," but Bear means it. And it means the world to me.
"Yeah, brother, I know. Thank you."
We shake, he pats me on the shoulder, and then he walks off toward his office, Rod trailing him, bitching at him the whole way.
"Yo," says Dean, putting a leash on Gladys, the French bulldog, to take her for her post-lunch constitutional. "Real talk? You know he's not bullshitting. We got you, man, you feel me?"
I shake my head and laugh a little, because I know he means it too. They all do. But the thing is, it's not because of me, it's because of Evan. They love Evan so much that they're honor-bound to have my back too, and I couldn't be more grateful for that.
"Yeah, bro," I say. "I feel you."
Dean goes to dap me off, but I kind of fuck up the handshake because I am a lot of things, but as cool as Dean is not one of them. Finally, he just slaps me on the back and says, "All good, baby," as he takes off with Gladys. I take the balled-up napkin that I've been fiddling with in my fingers and lob it across the station house. It lands dead in the middle of the trash can on the other side of the room. 3 points.
"We should go shoot around sometime," Evan says.
"You hate basketball," I remind him.
"Yeah, but I love bumping up against sweaty guys."
He smiles and nudges me.
"You gonna make it?"
he asks me.
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know, just... are you?" I take a deep breath and let it out on a long sigh. "Shit, I have no idea. I'm fucking trying." It's been an eventful couple of months. Evan chuckles.
"Yeah, I guess it has.
Hey, what are they saying about the fire?" Evan looks down and shakes his head.
"Electrical."
"Are you fucking kidding me? Fucking electrical?"
"I know," he says. "I know. But the official inspection report says that there was most probably a faulty outlet and that the breaker box wasn't up to code and blah, blah, blah. That's the official cause."
"Dude, there was a fucking explosion. I saw it."
"Caused by the chemicals contained in a stockpile of cleaning supplies."
"Jesus." I walk forward a few steps and then track back.
"I know, man," he says. "I know."
"And that doesn't fucking piss you off?"
"Of course it does," he tells me. "But I'm not the commissioner. What am I going to say? I have no hard proof I can provide, but I'm pretty sure that this was arson and that your inspector is on the take being paid off by a Mexican fucking crime boss. Yeah, that wouldn't go over real well. I got to work in this town, man."
"Dude," I start, but Evan cuts me off.
"Bro, it's Vegas. We do the best we can. I'm a firefighter, not a cop. I'm sorry."
Shit. Of course he's right. It's not his fault, and it's not his problem, and there's nothing he could do about it anyway. The only thing that any of us can do about it is already being done by Maddie.
"So when does all this go down?" he asks.
"Day after tomorrow." There's a long moment where we both stand in the open door of the station staring out at the sky. The winter sky in the desert looks like air. There's really no other way to describe it. Even with all the ways that we have polluted and fucked up the planet, tried as hard as we can to run it into fucking oblivion, there's something about a winter sky in the desert that looks pure and untouched and tranquil. It's an illusion, I know. There is no tranquility. There is no purity. And there's no place we can go that hasn't already been altered by our merely having been here. But sometimes it's nice to pretend. And then I look across the street and I see Brandon, new guy Brandon, sitting by himself on a bench in the park eating a sandwich. "What's all that about?" I ask. Evan shrugs and presses his lips together. "Since Jeff, he's been quiet, just kind of keeping to himself." "Unlike usual?" I ask, with the one eyebrow I can't arch lifted to its maximum level of suggested sarcasm.
"More to himself," says Evan.
Then he asks,
"You want to do anything special for Christmas?"
asks the Jew.
"Bro, I'm married to a dude who's so waspy that albinos are like, that guy is white. Christmas is like a whole thing. My hope is that with you there, we can make up some weird Christmas tradition where you make Robert, like, put live swans in the pool or something. That'd be hilarious. Swans are assholes."
Honestly, man. Until I know that Maddie's gonna be okay, I doubt I'm gonna have a lot of Christmas cheer to offer. Though if we really wanted to do something funny, we should try to force him to do a living manger, with me as Joseph, you as Mary, and make him be the baby. I like it. Feels like a long shot, though, Evan says. I know. I'm just spitballing. And suddenly I feel like I can't stand still. I'm thinking about Christmas without Maddie. And more importantly, what Maddie's Christmas is going to be like, stuck alone in a fucking compound somewhere with Carlos and Logan. And then I think of all the Christmases I spent in the Middle East with no one to talk to. And all those Christmases I spent drifting the planet with no one to talk to. Christmas after Christmas alone. No family who gave a shit, nobody to call back home. Except now I realize that I did have someone there all along. Someone who was waiting for me to reach out. And I blew it. I just fucking blew it. And now that we've found each other and we're together, we're being pulled apart again. But if recent history holds its course, I guess there's some hope, because Halloween was an actual horror show, but then Thanksgiving was a true moment of thanks and reparation, so possibly, if we're lucky, we can believe that we might get handed some kind of Christmas miracle. Jesus, I hope we can all just make it to the new year. Because then, just maybe, everything can start fresh for all of us, and, as Nadir would have said, joy shall cometh with the morning. Or else the whole goddamn world will just up and explode. Could go either way. Dude, I need to get back to Maddie, I say. Right on, Evan says, giving me one of the loving hugs only my brother can give. Come over the second she leaves, okay? I don't want to have to go chasing you down to make sure you're all right. Respect, I say, and slap his hand. He heads back inside the station, and I start off for my car. But then I glimpse Brandon again, just sitting there eating his sandwich. Fuck it. I trot across the street and come up to the side of him cautiously. I still don't know this dude at all, and I don't want to go sneaking up on some physically jacked, psychotically quiet firefighter I don't know. Dude, I say, kind of waving my hand and leaning in to let him see it's me. You mind if I sit for a second? The plastic grocery bag that holds the rest of his lunch, a banana, a bottle of apple juice, some animal crackers, is sitting on the bench beside him. He twists his head to look at me, chewing a bite of sandwich, then looks back in front of him and picks up the bag and moves it to the other side of him without a word. I take that as my invitation and sit down. Brandon takes another bite of his sandwich and continues staring ahead. I look to see what's in front of us. It's a dog park. There's five or so dogs and their owners inside the fence. The dogs are playing, running, you know, shit dogs do. And then, out of nowhere, just as I'm about to try to make some kind of overture to get the guy into a conversation, Brandon says, "They just are what they are." Sorry, what's that? He takes the final bite of his sandwich and he says, "Dogs, they're just dogs." I'll be honest, I'm not sure what my next move is here. Fortunately, and to my surprise, Brandon keeps talking. "They don't try to be something they're not, and nobody expects them to. They don't judge themselves, and they aren't judged. They run, they play, they eat, they sleep. And they love you if you don't hurt them. That's it." There's a long moment where we both watch the dogs all chasing each other, and then he says, "I hope if there's another life after this one, I get to be a dog." Shit. Brandon. "So, hey," I start. "What you did with Jeff was my job," he says, still looking straight ahead of him. I don't say anything, I just nod, because he's right. "What do you want to know?" he asks me after a moment. "Sorry?" "You want to know something. What is it?" He's right. I do want to know something about him. Anything, really, everything. I've been watching this dude for weeks now, and every time I see him, I wonder what his story is. And now that I'm sitting here with him, and he's inviting me to ask him, I find myself unable to make the words.
I mumble. I don't know. Why did you come over here from Heavy 44?
Shortage of manpower. They needed some volunteers to go to some other station, so I went.
Yeah?
Yeah, he says. Sorry if you wanted some big dramatic story, there isn't one. Help was needed, so I helped. What else?
I seriously don't know what to say. Are you doing
okay?
He turns his head to look at me again.
What do you mean?
Well, Jeff, and are you doing okay? He stares straight at me for a long time, just like he did on Halloween night when I asked him how he was doing. I don't look away. I just look into his eyes to see if I can find anything hidden there that I can understand. Finally, he says,
"It's because people are easily disappointed."
What? That was an answer to a question no one asked. Sorry, what?
That's why I don't talk to people. Which is what you want to know, why I don't talk to people. It's because then people expect stuff from you. Because they feel like they know you, or they understand you, but they don't. Nobody knows anybody.
Not really.
Because what can they know? The things you think. The things you say. None of that is you. You're not your thoughts. You're not the stuff you say. You're more than that. But people get attached to the stuff they think they can assign to you, and then that becomes who you are in their minds. And once they develop that attachment, they come to have expectations. And once someone has expectations, they can be disappointed. If you don't take that first step, then there won't be a second, and people go away and attach to somebody else who can disappoint them instead.
I don't speak. Not because I don't have anything to say, but because I have too much to say to put it into coherent language.
So that's all. That's why I don't talk to people.
I begin. But he cuts me off before I can continue.
But you already know all that, he says.
He turns and looks at me. I look back. Then he reaches into his plastic bag and opens the box of animal crackers. He pulls one out, then another, and places them to the side. Finally, sifting through, he finds a lion. He hands it to me. Then he digs out another lion, and then places the rest of the box down as well. He gives me a short, curt nod. Then he bites the head off the lion and turns back to look at the dogs playing in the park again. I slowly, carefully take a bite of my lion as well. And even though I'm anxious to get back to Maddie and be with her as much as I can before she goes, I sit for a moment, watching the dogs play without a care in the world and devour the king of the jungle.
Chapter 9. Maddie. December 22nd. 3 days before the artificial deadline that Carlos created in order to wield power over me. 3 days before I have to give him money I don't owe him or give him my body. So I'm packing to get ready to go. Ricky, Emily, and I have decided that I should go ahead and deliver myself to him tomorrow. Waiting doesn't make any sense. In this way, we can create something resembling a strategy. Waiting just delays the inevitable. So the plan is to tell Carlos that I called the number Ricky gave me, told him that I'm not going to be able to come up with the money, and that he convinced me to just bring myself to Carlos now. It will have the added benefit of gaining Ricky additional favor within the organization, because what I've also found out is that Carlos is none too happy with Logan about what happened to Pete. Apparently, killing Pete was never supposed to be part of the deal. Logan was supposed to make sure that Pete was out of the club before he and his goons burned it down. But we all know what happened there. So I guess Carlos is keeping a tight chain on his nephew now, and Ricky has been given most of Logan's old duties, notably keeping an eye on me, which is how he's been able to get close enough to recruit me into this whole thing without arousing suspicion. Christ, I feel like I'm in a fucking Jack Reacher book or some bullshit. How long are they saying you're going to be there, though? Tyler's standing in front of my bedroom door watching me pack. His arms are crossed. He looks like a sentry guarding the exit, which I suppose he is. I know when it comes time for me to leave in the morning, he's going to raise holy hell. Emily and Ricky argued about that. Ricky saying as long as it takes. Emily says that if I don't have anything useful in 2 weeks, they should pull me and then I disappear.
Disappear? Fuck does that mean?
I don't know. Witness protection, I guess? I get the sense that she's capping it at 2 weeks because that's about as long as she was able to keep herself safe with that drug gang that held her captive, and she only feels like she's got enough tricks to help me keep Carlos at bay for that long. I also get that sense that she and Ricky have a little something between them. Nothing I can prove, but the way she argued with him over the phone sounded familiar.
This is fucking stupid,
Tyler yells. Like I said, familiar.
And so you wind up in witness protection and then what? Do I ever see you again?
He's pouting a little, I think. Hard to tell behind the beard, but the voice sounds pouty. I cross over to him and put my hands on his chest. What? You won't come with me? I ask. He looks at me, a little surprised.
I'm invited?
Of course you're invited. Don't be dumb. If I wind up having to spend the rest of my life on the run, I'll want someone there to go to the grocery store for me and shit. He laughs a little, and while I do too, I'm also struck by the gravity of this whole thing for the first time. Hard to believe it's the first time it's dawning on me that this might result in me never seeing anyone I love again, which I guess really only consists of my mom and dad. There isn't anyone else, except Tyler, which is still a new concept. That he's here, I mean. Not that I love him. If I'm being honest with myself, I've known I love him for a long time. The fact that he's here is what's taking some getting used to. But he is here, and even though it makes me nervous to believe it, it doesn't look like he's going anywhere. But that's it. That's the whole of my world. Hell, I don't even really see anyone else. I haven't seen Caroline and Diane for days now. I don't know if they even still live here. I should poke my head in their rooms to see if their stuff is still there. God, have I really been so successful at walling myself off all this time? I guess so. Wow. Well, good for me, I suppose.
Hey, Tyler interrupts my thoughts. Listen, if there's a possibility we're just gonna wind up on the lam for the rest of our lives anyway, why go through with this? Let's just go now. I've got enough money to take care of us, and I've seen places on the planet where no one would ever find us. We could go to one of those, build a cabin and shit, and I'll hunt food for us. It'll be rustic as balls.
He tugs at my arms, but I pull away. He's being sweet and charming, and if I let myself, I'll just fall under his spell and take him up on the offer. And that would be the easy way out. And I've never been one for doing things the easy way. Which is fine. As long as you're smart about it. Which I think I am, but which I haven't been. Do you know the difference between hard work and struggle? I ask him.
What?
Hard work and struggle. Do you know the difference?
Yeah, he says. Hard work is, so you're working and, you know, it's hard. And so you do that, but when you struggle you have to, sorry, no, what's the difference?
Dork. Hard work, I tell him, is when you dig in and roll up your sleeves and you face down a problem. You engage with it and you figure out a way to get around it, and even if it's scary or difficult, you do it anyway. I think it was Einstein who said, you can't solve a problem with the same level of thinking that created it. And finding that new level of thinking requires hard work.
Okay.
Struggle, I pause, considering this carefully. Struggle is what I've been doing for the last 7 years. I let that sit there for a second so that I can make sure he's hearing me. I've been hammering away at the same problems in the same way with the same kind of effort, not bothering to pay attention to the fact that all that struggling was getting me nowhere. And the worst part about it? I take a breath because this is the hard part to say. The worst part is that I've been using Scotty as an excuse.
What? Tyler says. No, hey. I cut him off. No, I have. And you have too. Both of us used Scotty as an excuse not to move on. To just keep struggling away at the idea that we were moving forward. But both of us still stuck in the past. And I'm done with that. He nods slowly, like this is the first time he's ever considered this. It's not the first time I've considered it. I've thought about it a lot over the years. It's just the first time I've voiced it. And so, he asks, and so this is me doing something. Something that will help, that will, I don't know, have an impact on the world. And just as important, it'll put a nice, hard period at the end of this chapter of my life. And no matter how it plays out, I can close the book on it and actually move forward. Or that's my hope, anyway. That's a word I haven't really used a lot over these years. Hope. But there you go.
Okay, yeah, fair enough, he says with resignation. Hey, listen, I've got something for you.
He reaches into the duffel bag of clothes he's been keeping over here. Clothes is a stretch. It's really just a couple dozen t-shirts in different colors and an extra pair of jeans. I'm pretty sure that when he's done with them, he just throws them out and buys more instead of doing laundry. Fucking weirdo.
Here,
he says, pulling out what looks like a cell phone and handing it to me. What's that?
It's a sat phone.
Why do you have a sat phone?
It's for you, he says. I picked it up at Sat Phones R Us. It's right next to the drone store.
What do you want me to do with it?
I want you to keep it on you, and I want you to check in with me every night so that I know you're okay.
No, I say, waving the phone away. No way. It's too dangerous and—
Too dangerous? He shouts. This whole fucking thing is too dangerous. At least this way you won't be some floating satellite that I can't find, and you'll have a way to reach me if shit gets out of hand. It's encrypted and dedicated and untraceable. I paid for the fancy stealth package.
If they find a fucking sat phone on me, they won't. And even if they do, you can tell them it's just a regular phone. They won't know the difference. It's top of the line. Promise. Slayer told me. I try not to smile at that, but I fail. And then he's smiling too, sticking the phone in my hand.
Take it. Please. Okay? Just take it and promise that you'll call me, or at least ping me every night so that I know you're okay.
How do I do that? He shows me the features on the phone and how I can press a button to send him, like, Morse code and everything. And then he presses it into my palm and wraps my fingers around it.
Okay,
he asks. Please. I nod reluctantly, because I'm not sure this is such a great idea, but I have to admit that it gives me some small measure of comfort to think that I'll be able to reach him.
And take this, he says, taking off his watch.
Why?
Because you don't have one, and because in case... I don't know. I just want you to have it.
I examine it. I've seen it on his wrist, but never really paid attention. I'm not a watch girl, but it looks expensive, which isn't surprising. It also looks like it's been to hell and back, which it probably has.
Nadir gave it to me,
he says, looking at it.
Nadir, your business partner? The translator guy? Sure, yeah, that's him. My business partner.
He somehow mocks himself in saying the words back to me. It's nice, I say, studying it.
Yeah, says Tyler. It was a gift to him from a platoon he translated for before we met. I guess they gave it to him as a thank you.
Why'd he give it to you? Tyler blows out a breath.
I don't know. After we shook on partnering up on the bomb robot idea, he took it off and said, Tyler, please, you are doing a good thing. Please, take this and always remember that I am grateful.
He doesn't really get out the word grateful before his voice chokes off to a whisper, but I understand. Ty, I say, pushing the watch away, no, you shouldn't.
I didn't do a good thing, Mads. I didn't do a fucking thing. He gave me that because he thought I was a good guy and was helping him, and what I did instead was get him killed and spend the next few years fucking around and blowing money that was partially his. You, on the other hand, are about to do something brave and courageous and basically good. Trust me. If Nadir had met you, he would have wanted you to have it. He slides it on me. It dangles off my wrist. It's too big, I say. You should... I'll take a few links out. He cuts me off. But just take it, and promise to find some way to make contact with me at, I don't know, 11 o'clock every night. Please. I'll try. It might get kind of suspicious if no matter what's happening, I steal away at 11 every night. Can we just say, before the morning? His mouth tightens and he rolls his head, shifts his feet back and forth, but finally he says, fine. I give him a kiss and then go back to packing. Looking down at the sat phone in my hand, I'm struck by how small and compact it is. Not at all like the big, clunky one I used all those years ago when I was making calls to him when he was deployed. Calls that went unanswered. Just like the emails and letters. And suddenly, a thought lands on me. I have something for you too, I say.
Yeah? What?
As I walk over to my closet, my heart starts beating fast. I never thought in a million years that he'd actually wind up seeing this after all this time. I certainly didn't think I'd be sitting in front of him when he did. Reaching up to the top shelf, I fish around until my hand hits the shoebox. I swipe at it to bring it forward, and it falls off the shelf into my grasp. I take a deep breath and turn around, placing the box on the bed.
What's that? He asks.
I remove the lid, and inside are all the memories I've held onto. It makes me a little sad that every recollection, every reminiscence in my life that I've cared enough to keep can fit into a box small enough to hold just a pair of shoes. There's the business licenses from all the jobs I've failed to succeed at. There's a photo of me, Scotty, Mom, and Dad at the water park when I was probably 4. There's another photo of Scotty and Evan and Tyler, all gathered around me, finishing singing Happy Birthday on my 7th birthday. And there, at the bottom, buried under all the other memories I don't want to forget, I find it. I pull it out of the box, letting the other assorted images and papers fall away. And on one last puff of breath leaving my lungs, I hand it to Tyler.
Chapter 10. Tyler. I recognize it immediately. The last letter I ever got from Maddie while I was deployed. The one I sent back unopened. The one with my handwriting on the back. Please stop sending me letters. It's still sealed, the words she wrote entombed inside. I have some idea what's in here. She suggested a lot of things about it when she reminded me of its existence the night we found out we're us. My hands are shaking, and I can't pretend they're not because the jittering of the envelope betrays me. I flick at the paper with my middle finger and I don't look up. Just keep staring at the hurtful and selfish thing I wrote. Like if I stare hard enough, the words themselves will start to mean something else. Shit, I manage. Yeah, she says. After a moment, I ask, should I open it? She shrugs. Up to you. I nod and chew at the inside of my mouth.
But, like I told you back on Halloween, she says, it's a good one.
She wears a half smile that suggests she's as nervous about me reading it as I am. I continue to flick at the corner of the envelope, nodding my head ever so slightly all the while, like someone standing on the edge of a high dive, looking down into the water, deciding how they're going to find the courage to jump. And then, on a deep inhale, fuck it, I jump. I slide my finger under the lip of the seal and rip a jagged tear along the seam. Looking up at Maddie, I can see no easily identifiable expression on her face. She's caught somewhere between telling me to stop and breaking into a fit of nervous laughter. When I reach inside, the paper catches on the corner that I didn't completely sever with my finger and almost puts a rip in the letter itself, which would be just fucking perfect. I stop tugging and reset my hands like I'm performing delicate surgery. I rip away the rest of the offending corner and withdraw the contents, placing the envelope on the bed, a foot from where Maddie sits, one leg crossed underneath her, and the other dangling off the side. is folded in perfect thirds. Almost as if she used a ruler to create the folds, which, knowing Maddie, she very well may have. I lift the top flap and see her handwriting staring at me. The words, Dear Tyler, at the top. And for the first time, in my 30 years on Earth, it lands on me the way I supposed it's intended. Dear Tyler. Not hello, Tyler, or sup, Tyler, but Dear Tyler. My dear Tyler. Huh. I never really processed that before. I flip open the bottom third, and then it's just there, staring me in the face. A page of words sent to me by a friend in need that I never bothered to read. I'll bet these words never thought they'd see the light of day again. I'll bet that when they found themselves being stuffed inside that shoebox, they were like, well, that sucks. We're good words. Somebody took the time to write us down and shit, and now here we are just being shoved into a dark fucking coffin, never to get our shot at our job, which is to make someone feel something. Because that's all words are. Sounds that we put together to have an effect on another person. Like God slash James Franco told me during the brief period I was in heaven, they don't mean anything unless you give them meaning. I wonder what meaning these words will have on me now that they've been set free. Only one way to find out.
Dear Tyler. Hi, it's me, Maddie. I hope that you're well and safe and that the other soldiers are being nice to you. So listen, I'm writing because, as I'm sure you're aware, we're coming up on Scotty's anniversary. That's a shitty thing to call it, I know, because an anniversary usually implies something happy that you want to celebrate, but I really don't have a better word for it. And I guess the idea that an anniversary has to be a happy thing is just something we made up anyway. People, I mean. Ugh, people. The worst. Am I right? LOL. Anyway, I don't know if you've gotten all the other letters I sent because I haven't heard back. It's fine if you didn't. They were mostly just, like, check-ins or updates about what's going on here and stuff. A couple of them had little things I made tucked inside. I know you always loved the potholders that I would make, LOL. But seriously, you should actually try crocheting yourself. I mean it. It's super calming. It's really helped me a lot this year. No kidding. I hope, if nothing else, you got the package I sent with the chain. I found this gold chain. Don't worry, it was fake. I paid like $5 for it. That had a name tag on it that said, Asshole. I thought of you the second I spotted it, LOL. So anyway, I hope you got that at least. I've tried to call a bunch too and sent emails and stuff, but I can't know for sure if you're getting the messages or if the emails are getting lost on some government email server or something. And if that's what's happening, or if the letters and packages I've sent aren't being delivered, I guess I'll never know. But I'm sending this one because I'm not doing so good, Ty. Now, I don't want you to freak out and come running back to Vegas on the next plane out of wherever you are right now just for me, haha. I mean, I kind of do, of course, because it'd be awesome to see you, but I don't want you to, like, worry about me doing anything bad to myself or anything like that, because that's not what I'm saying, and that's not what I'm about. I just feel sad, like, all the time, and there's really nobody here who gets it or who I can talk to. You know how Mom and Dad are. They say hi, by the way. They just kind of shove shit down and pretend everything's okay all the time. Which, don't get me wrong, I love them, and I'm so grateful they're here. I don't know what I'd do if they weren't. Sometimes I feel like they're the only thing keeping me together. So, I mean, I have them, thank God, and that's great. But they're my parents, you know? Not my friends. And I don't have a lot of friends, Ty. Now, I'm not throwing a pity party. Oh, woe is Maddie. No, none of that. It's just true. I feel like I was starting to make a few friends in my first semester, but then, you know, and that kind of fucked all that up, so... And it's okay not to have a lot of friends, right? I think you feel that way, too, probably.
I've always kind of thought we were the same that way. You don't need a lot of friends when you've got one or two really good ones. Like how you and Scotty and Evan had each other. And I guess, like how I had you guys too. Because, I mean, that's the thing. I know you probably didn't feel this way because you're older and a guy and stuff, so I don't know if you ever noticed. But I always kind of saw myself as the fourth musketeer with you three. Aramis or Porthos, probably. I don't think I'm Athos, and you're definitely D'Artagnan. LOL. But seriously, I don't know if you saw how much I followed you guys around, but I did. Mom and Dad used to give me a hard time about it. Did I ever tell you that? They did. I think Mom was worried I was a lesbian or something. That's why she was always shoving me in dresses and shit. I don't know if you remember the time I asked for a fire hat for Christmas because you guys all had them, and she got me a Barbie dream house instead. I know Scotty would remember, because we set it on fire. The box said it was flame retardant, so we decided to see. I blame the manufacturer. Don't claim that shit unless you can back it up. Anyway, I'm not a lesbian, by the way. Like, I am so totally not a lesbian. Not that it's a bad thing or whatever, just, I'm not one. I just want to make that clear, that's all. Because, shit, I've tried to write this like 3 times, and each time I scratch this part out and throw it in the trash. I'm only telling you that because my wrist is getting tired, and I'm running out of stationery, and I don't want to do it again. So I feel like maybe giving that disclaimer will help me just write it this time, and not scratch it out or throw it away. So, okay, here goes. Because here's the thing. And I know this will sound crazy, okay? Let's just get that out of the way right now. I'm not stupid. And I know that feelings are just feelings and they come and go and that you grow up and stuff and when you do, things change and whatever. I know that. But mine haven't. Changed, I mean. I'm 19 now and I still feel exactly the same way I did when I was 9. And that's 10 years. That's more than half my life. That's a long time. Half your life, I mean. So the point is that when I say this, when I tell you what I'm about to tell you, don't think it's just because I'm feeling needy or because I'm lonely or because of what happened to Scotty, okay? Because I'm not, okay? I'm not. I'm really, really not. This is really how I feel, and it's real. I love you. Like, I love you. Tyler. I always have. Ever since I was a little kid, and then a middle-sized kid, and then a big kid, and now as like a grown-up type person. I love you. And I hope that doesn't weird you out or send you running, because that's the last thing I want to do. The last thing. I just wanted you to know so that whenever it is you finally come back, you are coming back, right? Whenever that is. I want you to know I'll be here. I mean, I don't want to presume that you feel the same way or have you think I expect anything of you, because I don't. I really don't. But I just needed you to know. Because it's been really, really hard this last almost year. And one of the things that's got me through is thinking I'll see you again. And look, if this sounds crazy because it's been, you know, like 6 years since we've seen each other, I get that. It sounds crazy to me too. But just because something's crazy doesn't mean it's not true. It's not a lie. It's just a lot. So, I hope this letter finds you. And if it does, just know that it would mean the world to me to hear from you. Anything. Just any small thing letting me know that you're okay and that you're keeping your head up. Because even though it's hard, trust me, I know it's hard. That's where I'm keeping mine. I'll be looking for you. Ever and always yours. Maddie. Chapter 11. Maddie and Tyler. I can't make out the look on his face as he's reading. His head is down. He sniffs out a laugh a couple times, which is nice. I don't remember what I wrote word for word, but I do remember trying to put some jokes in. Because I thought he'd appreciate it, so I'm glad that he seems to. It feels like it's taking a really long time for him to read the whole thing, and even though I want to ask him questions or say something to him, I force myself to sit there quietly until he finishes and looks up at me. And then he does, and his eyes are glistening. He swallows, shakes his head a tiny bit, closes his eyes, and smiles a bittersweet smile. "I told you it was pretty good," I say. He opens his eyes, and suddenly he's on top of me, pressing my back against the bed and kissing me with the urgency of someone who's been stranded in the desert for days and just got handed a glass of water. He takes the back of my head in his hands and presses his forehead to mine. He's gripping me tightly, but at the same time pulling back, like he wants to squeeze me with all his strength, but knows that if he does, he'll crush my skull, which I assume neither of us wants. "I'm so, so sorry," he says, his voice quavering. "I know," I say. "No, you don't," he assures me. "I am sorrier than I will ever be able to explain." "It's okay," I say, stroking his cheek. "I should have been there." "Yeah," I say. "That would have been nice, but you're here now."
"But when you needed me..."
I lean forward and shush him with a kiss. "Living in the past, babe," I say, and wink. He pushes up off of me and sits next to me on the edge of the bed. I sit up and join him. He takes my hand. We don't talk. He just looks at my hand in his. Finally, after a minute, I ask him, "What are you thinking about?" And in true Tyler Morgan fashion, there's no way I can predict his answer.
Daniel Day-Lewis? That's what I tell her. That's what I'm thinking.
"What?"
she asks.
"Daniel, the actor? Why?
Do I remind you of Daniel Day-Lewis?"
"No,"
I laugh.
"Okay, good. Although he is very talented, so I suppose.
You ever see The Last of the Mohicans?"
"No,"
she says. Then adds,
"I read the book."
"Pfft, book," I say with some scorn. "Reading, blech." She smiles and nods like she's tolerating me, silently asking me to go on. There's a famous quote from the movie where he goes, "Stay alive. No matter what occurs, I will find you. No matter how long it takes, no matter how far, I will find you."
"Yeah, I know," she says. "It's also from the book."
"Okay, well, wherever it's from, it's all I can think of. It just keeps running through my head over and over." I roll our interlaced fingers over so that I can see the back of her hand. It's strong but delicate. Long fingers and white skin. Veins that tense with the clench of her grip. Freckles. Just a few light, faint, perfect freckles. I have the same thought I had the other day, that I want to learn her, her body, every millimeter of her. I want it burned into my brain. I want to imprint her into my memory before she goes. I want to study her. I want to have a PhD in Maddie Clayton. I let go of her hand and stand up, turn to face her, and then kneel down.
"What are you doing?"
she asks. I don't say anything. She's not wearing shoes, so I start tugging at the toes of her socks, and she giggles as I work them off her legs and then hold her precious feet in my hands, examining them. I stroke the bones that run along the top, ending at the tips of her toes, and I kiss each toe one by one. I turn them over to inspect the scar I found the other day, and I give it a kiss. Then I spread her legs and slide in between them, popping my head up to give her a kiss on the lips before I unbutton her jeans and draw down the zipper. She leans back, propping herself on her elbows, and shimmies her hips as I pull her pants down. They're so tight on her, so fitted, that they draw her underwear along with them as I pull, and then the pants are off her body and on the floor, and her bare calves and knees and thighs and pussy are there for me to explore. Still leaning back on her elbows, she tilts her head to the side, presses her lips together in a tight smile, and raises her eyebrows at me. I lift one of her legs and place my face right next to it, like an archaeologist exploring the contours of a priceless ancient artifact. Her smell. Her smell will be the thing that I know I will hold on to most. It's always been that way for me. Smell is the most potent sense I have when it comes to triggering memories. When I smell cinnamon, I remember my mom. Because she was baking when she collapsed that last time after chemo. And so that's the smell I choose to associate with my final memory of her, as opposed to the antiseptic smell of the hospital. Because that wasn't her anymore anyway. Mom stayed in the kitchen. Only the shell of her stuck around for a couple weeks more in the hospital bed. Anyway. Right now, Maddie smells like freshly cut grass. She's been packing and getting ready to leave all day, and it's been weirdly warm of late, so she's a little sweaty. And that smell, that pungent, dense, round smell of sweat on her skin that fills my nostrils, reminds me of summer. Which I love, because I suppose that means that for the rest of my life, there'll be an entire season where every day, all I'll be able to think about is her. Even though I don't imagine needing a lot of prompts to steer my thoughts in her direction. As I stroke my fingers along her leg, kissing as I go, and drinking in her scent with every breath, she drops down from her elbows, letting herself lie flat on her back, her legs dangling off the side of the bed. She traces her fingers up and down the line of her stomach, pushing her t-shirt up to the curve of her breasts as I continue my survey of her flesh. I'm discovering things. Things that no one else on earth besides me will know. Her right calf appears just infinitesimally stronger than her left. Her left knee is the teeniest bit knobbier than her right. And when I kiss her behind either of her knees, she shudders through her stomach, causing her toes to crinkle. As I pass the bend in her knee, I draw my nose along the inside of her thigh. She wriggles a teeny bit as my beard moves along her soft skin. And then my mouth is right at the brink of her entrance. I take my thumb and run it along the pink folds, and she lets out a mmm. I tilt my head, studying my fingers as they massage her tender skin, and take note of what sound each gesture evokes from her. Kissing tenderly on her opening causes her to growl from somewhere deep inside her throat, so I do. I kiss, and I let my warm breath signal my presence, but I don't want to penetrate her. Not this way. If she wants me to be inside her, I will happily oblige, but for now, I just want to be here with her and hold her close. And I will. And I will hold her close in my thoughts every second that she's gone. But more importantly, I will hold her in my heart.
Some people search their whole life looking for that one place they belong, for that one person who gets them, who brings them into their world, lets them fall easily into the pull of their gravity, and lets them just be, just exist, quietly, naturally, freely. This is Tyler for me, the center of my universe, the man around whom I now orbit. Not like a satellite either, but like two things meant to be one. Like long ago something crashed into us, broke us into little pieces, and left us adrift, floating in directionless space, spinning wildly with no tether. And now we've been pulled back together, and we circle each other, still spinning, but with the purpose of joining, of becoming one thing again. Not because of tragedy, the way I'd imagined when I sent that letter. It's not a lifeline of salvation connecting us now, but some force of nature we can't explain, or control, or bend to our will. Some law of the universe that dictates the fate of things. We are connected by something more powerful than shared sorrow, and every moment we've spent apart has been valuable, necessary, critical. His mouth between my legs feels wonderful. I could close my eyes and enjoy it, let myself reach the heights of pleasure. But alone? No. I'm done doing things alone. We're connected now, and everything we do will be together. So I whisper, Tyler, as I caress his head, run my fingers through his hair, touch his shoulders, slide my fingertips up and down the hills and valleys of his muscular arms.
He looks up at me, his eyes smiling even though they're half closed, even though his mouth is still working, his tongue still flicking against my pussy. "Come up here," I say, "and kiss my mouth." Now he smiles with his whole face. His hands plant on either side of my hips and he draws himself up to standing. He lifts his t-shirt over his head and undoes his jeans, letting them fall to the floor, and his nakedness reminds me that he has lived every single day of his time on this earth. He leans onto the bed and eases forward. My legs open wider for him, welcome him between them as his cock, hard and long and ready, rests against my clit, making me want him. If we stopped right now, if he just rested his chest on top of my breasts, became nothing more than heavy weight as he closed his eyes, relaxed, and fell asleep, I'd be content, happy, and satisfied. And not because there'd be more chances to do this later, but because it's him I want, not the sex. He leans down, his hands on either side of my head now, bending the mattress the way space-time bends around a sun. And when his lips reach mine, my eyes are closed. And I fall again. I fall far and long and easily, the same way I drifted towards him. And as I drift, weightless, we kiss. But I'm still connected to him, always next to him. Because this is what it feels like to fall into someone, not away. This is not me slipping down the mountain. This is not me losing my footing. This is me finding myself. In him. In us. So when I reach my hand between my legs and place him right where he needs to be, he enters me. And all those broken, spinning pieces come together to once again create the thing we were always meant to become. Our bodies move together, perfectly synchronized, like the dance of stars in space. His body is hot, and my body is hot, and the heat we create between us doesn't burn like fire, but rearranges us, like the molecules of two metals mixing to form the strongest sword made of the very best steel. Our lovemaking is slow and perfect. We reach the heights of pleasure together, as one, and it's the kind of climax that only happens once in a lifetime. The kind of release that means more than the way it makes you feel. It tells you who you are, and who you're with, and exactly where you fit in the grand scheme of things. He says, "I love you, medicine." And I say it back, "I love you, Tyler." We mold ourselves into each other as we relax and grow sleepy, our bodies back together, his arms around me, my back pressed against his chest. Our hearts beating. Keeping time. Becoming what we were always meant to be. Chapter 12. Maddie. I see a lot staring out the window of Rick's car as we drive south, towards Mexico. But then again, I see nothing. Because I'm picturing Tyler when I left him behind this morning. He tilted his head a little like he was about to veto the whole thing, but I did this little head shake in response. A no. A soft one, but still a no. It was hard to say goodbye, but we did it. I refused to cry because that wouldn't be fair to him. This was my decision, so I have to be strong no matter what. But I was sad, and he was sad, so... I glance at the watch on my wrist. Tyler's watch. Nadir's watch. It's not lost on me that history is nothing more than the passage of time, and that we record time to give us some sense of our place in our own stories. And now we've been driving for hours, in silence. Complete, dead silence. Ricky and I haven't said one word to each other. Ricky is staying in character, and I'm too paranoid that Carlos might have the car bugged, so I've been dwelling on my decision. Was it really a decision? I mean, I guess I could have let Tyler pay the money, but would that have been the end of it? Would Carlos really have let me go? No. There was never a decision to be made because it was made for me. Somehow, some way,
I got Carlos Castillo's attention. And like Pete said, you're in Castillo's orbit now. There's no getting out of it. He was wrong, though, wasn't he?